So Lumpaz just asked me to do a couple of the readings. He's pretty much organized it and chosen these, but just to give a break so he doesn't have to talk the whole time. He asked if I would do some of the readings as well. And this one is, as he was saying, from this book called Samana by Lungpa Mahabua, Ajahn Mahabua. And gave a little background there, but Ajahn Mahabua died at the age of 97, just a couple of years ago, 2011. And this book here was published after he passed away. The first section that I'm going to read out is a little bit autobiographical, just about his growing up and some of his time with his family and the culture that he grew up in. And even though it's specific to Lungpa Mahabua himself, it kind of gives a nice flavor of the environment that this generation of Thai forest masters grew up in, the kind of the culture and the surroundings, the people. So that's this first part here. My mother was a wonderfully patient and devoted woman. She told me that of all the 16 children she carried to birth, I was by far the most troublesome in the womb. I was either so still in her stomach that she thought I must have already died, or I was thrashing around so violently that she thought I must have been on the verge of death. The closer I came to birth, the worse those extremes became. Just before I was born, my mother and my father each had an auspicious dream. My father dreamed that he had received a very sharp knife pointed at the tip with an elephant husk handle and encased in a silver sheath. My father felt very pleased. My mother, on the other hand, dreamed that she had received a pair of gold earrings, which were so lovely that she couldn't resist the temptation to put them on and admire herself in the mirror. The more she looked, the more they impressed her. My grandfather interpreted these two dreams to mean that the course of my life would follow one of two extremes. If I chose the way of evil, I would be the most feared criminal of my time. My character would be so fearsome that I was bound to end up being a crime boss of unprecedented daring and ferocity, who'd never allow himself to be captured alive and imprisoned, but would hide out in the jungle and fight the authorities to the death. At the other extreme, if I chose the way of virtue, my goodness would be unequaled. I'd be bound to ordain as a Buddhist monk and become a field of merit for the world. When I grew up, I noticed that all the older boys were getting married, so I thought that's what I wanted too. One day, an old fortune teller came to visit the house of my friend. In the course of conversation, my friend blurted out that he wanted to ordain as a monk. The old man looked a bit annoyed and then asked to see the boy's hand. "Let's take a look at the lines in your palm to see if you're really going to be a monk." "Oh, look at this. There's no way you'll ordain." "But I really want to ordain." "No way. You'll get married first." I suddenly got an itch to ask the old man about my fortune, since I was hoping to marry at that time. I had no intention to ordain. When I stuck my hand out, the old man grabbed it and exclaimed, "This is the guy that's going to ordain." "But I want to get married." "No way. Your ordination line is full. Before long, you'll be a monk." My face went flush because I wasn't intending to be a monk at all. I wanted to have a wife. It was strange, really. After that, whenever I thought of marrying a girl, some obstacle would arise to prevent it. I even had a narrow escape after I ordained, when a girl I previously had a crush on came looking for me at the monastery, only to find that I had just moved to another place. If she'd caught me in time, who knows? While I was growing up, I had no particular desire to become a monk. It took me a while to focus my attention on it. When I was 20, I fell seriously ill, so ill that my parents were constantly sitting at my bedside. My physical symptoms were severe. At the same time, a decision on whether or not to ordain weighed heavily on my mind. I felt the Lord of Death closing in on me. My whole life seemed to be in the balance. My parents sat anxiously beside me, not daring to speak. My mother, who was usually very talkative, just sat there crying. Eventually, my father couldn't hold back his tears. They both thought I was going to die that night. Seeing my parents crying in despair, I made the solemn vow that should I recover from that illness, I would ordain as a Buddhist monk for their sake. As though in response to my intense resolve, my symptoms began to slowly fade away. By dawn, they had disappeared completely. Instead of dying that night, as expected, I made a full recovery. But following my recovery, the intensity of my resolve waned. My inner virtue kept reminding me that I had made a solemn promise to ordain. So why was I procrastinating? Several months of indecision passed, even though I kept acknowledging my failure to live up to my resolution. Why hadn't I ordained yet? I knew I had no choice but to ordain. I had to honor the agreement I made with the Lord of Death, my life in exchange for ordination. I willingly conceded that ordination was inevitable. I wasn't trying to avoid it, but I needed a catalyst. That catalyst came during a frank discussion with my mother. Both she and my father were pleading with me to ordain. Finally, their tears forced me to make the decision that marked my path in life. My father wanted me to ordain so badly that he began to cry. As soon as my father started crying, I was startled. My father's tears were no small matter. I reflected on my father's tears for 3 days before finalizing my decision. At the end of the third day, I approached my mother and announced my intention to ordain, adding the provision that I be allowed the freedom to give up the robes whenever I felt inclined. I made it clear that I wouldn't ordain if I was forbidden to disrobe. But my mother was too clever. She said that if I wanted to disrobe immediately after the ordination ceremony, in front of all the people in attendance, she wouldn't object. She'd be satisfied to see me standing there in yellow robes. That was all she asked. Of course, who would be foolish enough to immediately disrobe right there in front of the preceptor with the whole village in attendance? My mother easily outsmarted me on that one. Soon after my ordination, I began reading the story of the Buddha's life, which immediately awakened a strong sense of faith in my heart. I was so moved by the Buddha's struggle to attain enlightenment that tears rolled down my cheeks as I read. Contemplating the scope of his attainment instilled in me a fervent desire to gain release from suffering. Toward that purpose, I decided to formally study the Buddha's teachings as a preparation for putting them into practice. With that aim in mind, I made a solemn vow to complete the third grade of Pali studies. As soon as I passed the third level Pali exams, I planned to follow the way of practice. I had no intention to study further or take exams for the higher levels. When I traveled to Chiang Mai to take my exams, by chance, Venerable Ajahn Mun arrived at Wat Chedi Luang in Chiang Mai at the time I did. As soon as I learned that he was staying there, I was overwhelmed with joy. When I returned for my alms round next morning, I learned from another monk that Ajahn Mun left for alms on a certain path and returned by the very same path. This made me even more eager to see him. Even if I couldn't meet him face to face, I'd be content just to have a glimpse of him before he left. The next morning, before Ajahn Mun went on his alms round, I hurried out early for alms and then returned to my quarters. From there, I kept watch on the path by which he would return, and before long I saw him coming. With a longing that came from having wanted to see him for such a long time, I peeked out from my hiding place to catch a glimpse of him. The moment I saw him, a feeling of complete faith arose within me. I felt that because I had now seen an Arahant, I hadn't wasted my birth as a human being. Although no one had told me that he was an Arahant, my heart became firmly convinced of it the moment I saw him. At the same time, a feeling of sudden elation, hard to describe, came over me, making my hair stand on end. The story of his ordination up to the time he saw Ajahn Mun for the first time. Good example of the awakening of the quality of faith. Mm-hmm. So another section here. Comparing myself with Venerable Ajahn Mun, I could see that we were very different. When Ajahn Mun looked at something, he comprehended it thoroughly and in a way that was just right from every angle in the heart. He never focused on only one side, but always used wisdom to see the broader picture. This lesson I learned many times while living with him. In that way, studying with Ajahn Mun wasn't simply a matter of studying teachings about the Dhamma. I had to adapt myself to the practices he followed until they were firmly in my own thoughts, words, and deeds. Living with him for a long time allowed me to gradually observe his habits and his practices, and to understand the reasoning behind them, until that knowledge was firmly embedded in my heart. I felt a great sense of security while living with him, because he himself was all Dhamma. At the same time, staying in his presence forced me to be always watchful and restrained. Ajahn Mun had a habit of chanting every night for several hours. Hearing him softly chanting in his hut one evening, I had the mischievous urge to sneak up and listen. I wanted to find out what he chanted at such length every night. But as soon as I crept up close enough to hear him clearly, his voice stopped and remained silent. This didn't look good, so I quickly backed away and stood listening from a distance. No sooner had I backed away than I heard the low cadence of his chanting start up again, now too faint to be heard clearly. So again I sneaked forward, and again he went silent. In the end, I never did find out what he was chanting. I was afraid that if I stubbornly insisted on eavesdropping, a bolt of lightning might strike and a sharply deep thunder out. Meeting him the next morning, I glanced away. I did not dare look him in the face. But he looked directly at me with a sharp, menacing glare. I learned my lesson the hard way. Never again did I dare to sneak up and try to listen in on his chanting. I was afraid I would receive something severe for my trouble. I had heard that Ajahn Mun could read other people's minds, and this intrigued me. So one day I decided to test him to see if it was true. Ajahn Mun would. In the afternoon, I prostrated three times before the Buddha statue and set up a determination in my heart. Should Ajahn Mun know what I am thinking at this moment, then let me receive a clear and unmistakable sign that will dispel all my doubts. Later that afternoon, I went to Ajahn Mun's hut to pay my respects. When I arrived, he was sewing patches on his robes, so I offered to help. As soon as I approached him, his expression changed and his eyes grew fierce. Something didn't feel right. I tentatively put my hand out to take a piece of cloth, but he quickly snatched it from my grasp with a short grunt of displeasure. "Don't be a nuisance." Things didn't look good at all, so I sat quietly and waited. After a few minutes of tense silence, Ajahn Mun spoke. Normally, a practicing monk has to pay attention to his own mind and observe his own thoughts. Unless he's crazy, he doesn't expect someone else to look into his mind for him. In the lengthy silence that followed, I felt humbled and my mind surrendered to him completely. I made a solemn vow never again to challenge Ajahn Mun. After that, I respectfully asked permission to help him sew his robe, and he made no objection. A little taste of Ajahn Mahabua and a little vision of what Ajahn Mun was like from his eyes.
Both Ajahn Mahabua and Ajahn Chah were students of Ajahn Mahabua. Did they seem to have different experiences, or were they pretty much similar in what they shared about how they were taught them?
Well, Ajahn Mahabua spent a lot of time with Ajahn Mun over a period of time and at different times. So he had a lot of contact. Ajahn Chah had very little contact. Spent a few days with him and that was it. He was inspired by his example. And then, part of it is the kind of the Mahanikaya Dhammayut kind of split. So that Ajahn Chah ended up spending more time with students of Ajahn Mun who were Mahanikaya and who had spent more time with him early on. I think it was probably as Ajahn Mun got more and more disciples then there probably started to have to be a bit more structure around the Mahanikaya and Dhammayut monks that were close to him, whereas before it was probably a bit more fluid, so that Ajahn Chah ended up spending not much time. But certainly different monks experienced Ajahn Mun in different ways. And it actually, fostered when Ajahn Mahabua wrote a biography of Ajahn Mun, then it spawned another biography from other disciples who had a different experience with Ajahn Mun, which is quite ordinary. Different people experience Ajahn Chah in different ways. So that is quite ordinary, really. But I think certainly Ajahn Mun was a really formidable teacher. You wouldn't want to be frivolous around him. like this picture here, that's Ajahn Mun. If of all the pictures that exist of Ajahn Mun, that's Ajahn Mun at his warmest and fuzziest. But then, of course, there's a tendency to, pose for pictures. This is taken in probably like early 1940s. So if you pose for pictures, you wouldn't have a natural picture taken. and that was also part of the picture that was painted of Ajahn Mun by other disciples of his warmth, of his wit, of his ability to tell a story that engaged people in a way that they'd be really light, and so it's a different picture than the kind of the fierce taskmaster. Different people that experienced him in different ways. Yeah, Matt.
Are there any monasteries associated with Ajahn Sao, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mandala, like modern monasteries now?
Yeah, absolutely. They're all over the northeast of Thailand. Where Ajahn Mun ended up focusing he was from Ubon, and many of his early disciples were from Ubon. But he was never really accepted in Ubon for some reason. So that he ended up spending the majority of his time on the northern part of the northeast. That area up in that northern part of the northeast of Thailand is riddled with forest monasteries that are, either small or large, with large communities or small communities. So it's all over. And say like Ajahn Chah ended up being Ubon's kind of patron saint in the end. Anywhere you go in sort of Ubon and the neighboring provinces, you're going to come across you can almost throw a stone and you'll find a branch monastery of Ajahn Chah. Yeah, they're all over.
When we wander around that area at the end of the year, so that's what I was asking.
Oh, yeah. No, they're all over. And both, really highly regarded and you know, well-known monasteries, and then lots of little known, hardly known at all place.
I was just wondering if the popularity of meditation in Thailand now extends to the villages around the forest monasteries as well as the urban areas, and did one come first and one come later, or does it just vary by...
It varies, and it depends on the teacher, really.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I mean, that was the thing that just, you know, really blew my mind when I went to Ajahn Chah's monastery, early 1974, and the hall full of lay people meditating, practicing, and I could not conceive of how they could sit so still and so long. There's around the monasteries, it was, and same at Wat Nanga Cha. Right now, Wat Nanga Cha, Wat Pa Phong, you know, once a week, you know, it's just like, you know, here you have the Lunar Observance Day, and the people come for the meal, and they spend the day, and they spend the night. Some people aren't able to come during the day, they'll come at the night time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's rare at Wat Nanga Cha to have less than 100 people for the, you know, the all-night observance, meditation vigil.
Mm-hmm.
For Wat Pa Phong, you know, it's probably rare to have less than 200 on an ordinary, Yeah, it's not a small thing.
Mm-hmm.
People just plug in.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do. And of course, when you have ceremonies, ceremonial days, and it's huge. The numbers of people who come and practice and meditate and chant at the either in June or January when. And the Sangha gathers. June is the observance of Ajahn Chah's birth. January is the observance of Ajahn Chah's death. And thousands of people sitting and chanting and meditating together. I mean, the hall is full. The area around it is full. The approach to it is full. You know, now they've got set up with closed circuit TVs, so you can, people can sort of see and join in. Yeah, it's very inspiring.
So the whole country meditates, it sounds like. Or where there's the
influence. Well, where there's good examples,
mm-hmm.
and people plug in.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. Okay, the next reading is from Upasika Gilana Yon, who is a sometimes we focus on the, you know, what's closest to us in the say Ajahn Mun tradition, Ajahn Chah, but in Thailand there's other forest traditions, and Ajahn Buddhadasa is somebody who is very well known, and then Upasika Gi Nana Yon she trained and studied under Ajahn Buddhadasa, and she led a community. And her teaching spread through Thailand, and she's from the central part of Ratchaburi, which is central part of Thailand, and sort of but heading a bit toward the south. So that's a kind of, there's not much overlap between that and the northeast of Thailand. But once her teachings started to come out, they're all over the country and all over the forest monasteries, because Ajahn Yatiko was saying, when he was staying with Ajahn Wangchai, who was a highly regarded disciple of Ajahn Mahabua's forest monastery northeast of Thailand, then Ajahn Wangchai encouraged him to read Upasikagina. So that her expression of the teachings and the ethos of the practice are very, very similar to the kind of lineage, emphasis on mindfulness, awareness, on reflection, investigation. And of course, I mean, she's speaking from the basis of having established a community that is very committed to sila and simplicity. And her, so her that teaching is encapsulated in a, I mean, this book, An Unentangled Knowing, is that's the title of the whole book. But there's a that gives a sense of her what was really important for her in her emphasis. There's a, where she's saying, only when there can be awareness, righted awareness, will you really be able to know that the mind that is aware of awareness in this way doesn't send its knowing outside of this awareness. There are no issues. Nothing can be concocted in the mind when it knows in this way. In other words, an inward staying, unentangled knowing, all outward going knowing cast aside. A very beautiful expression. Her very direct but eloquent expression of the teachings were very much cherished by practitioners all through the country. There was a real directness to her way, her approach. So I thought I would read a short talk that she gave. And there's no in these, there's no real, I say, chronology or record of when most of her talks were given at her center. To her community. It's important that we discuss the steps of the practice in training the mind, for the mind has all sorts of deceptions by which it fools itself. If you aren't skillful in investigating and seeing through them, they are very difficult to overcome, even if you are continually mindful to keep watch over the mind. You have to make an effort to focus on contemplating these things at all times. Mindfulness on its own won't be able to give rise to any real knowledge. At best, it can give you only a little protection against the effects of sensory contact. If you don't make a focused contemplation, the mind won't be able to give rise to any knowledge within itself at all. This is why you have to train yourself to be constantly aware all around. When you come to know anything for what it really is, there's nothing but letting go. Letting go. On the beginning level, this means the mind won't give rise to any unwise or unprofitable thoughts. It will simply stop to watch, stop to know within itself at all times. If there's anything you have to think about, keep your thoughts on the themes of inconstancy, stress, and not self. So I need to go back down. You have to keep the mind thinking and labeling solely in reference to these sorts of themes. For if your thinking and labeling are right, you'll come to see things rightly. If you go the opposite way, you'll have to think wrongly and label things wrongly. And that means you'll have to see things wrongly as well. This is what keeps the mind completely hidden from itself. Now, when thoughts or labels arise in the mind, then if you focus on watching them closely, you'll see that there are sensations. Sensations of arising and disbanding, changeable, unreliable, and illusory. If you don't make an effort to keep a focused watch on them, you'll fall for the deceptions of thought fabrication. In other words, the mind gives rise to memories of the past and fashions issues dealing with the past. But if you're aware of what's going on in time, you'll see that they're all illusory. There's no real truth to them at all. Even the meanings the mind gives to good and bad sensory contacts at the moment they occur. If you carefully observe and contemplate, you'll see that they're all deceptive. There's no real truth to them. But ignorance and delusion latch onto them all, and this drives the mind around in circles. In other words, it doesn't know what's what, how these things arise, persist, and disband. So it latches onto them and gets itself deceived on many, many levels. If you don't stop to focus and watch, there's no way you can see through these things at all. But if the mind keeps its balance or stops to watch and know within itself, it can come to realize these things for what they are. When it realizes them, it can let them go automatically without being attached to anything. This is the knowledge that comes with true mindfulness and discernment. It knows and lets go. It doesn't cling. No matter what appears, good or bad, pleasure or pain, when the mind knows, it doesn't cling. When it doesn't cling, there's no stress or suffering. You have to keep hammering away at this point. When it doesn't cling, the mind can stay at normalcy, empty, undisturbed, quiet, and still. But it doesn't read itself in this way, doesn't know itself in this way. It will fall for the deceits of defilement and craving. It will fashion up all sorts of complex and complicated things that itself will have a hard time seeing through. For they will have their ways of playing up to the mind to keep it attached to them, all of which is simply a matter of the mind's falling for the deceits of the defilements and cravings within itself. The fact that it isn't acquainted with itself, doesn't know how mental states arise and disband and take on objects, means that it loses itself in its many, many attachments. There's nothing as hard to keep watch of as the mind, because it's so accustomed to wrong views and wrong opinions. This is what keeps it hidden from itself. But thanks to the teachings of the Buddha, we can gain knowledge into the mind, or into consciousness, with its many layers and intricacies, which when you look into it deeply, you'll find to be empty. Empty of any meaning in and of itself. This is an emptiness that can appear clearly within consciousness. Even though it's hidden and profound, we can see into it by looking inward in a way that's quiet and still. The mind stops to watch, to know within itself. As for sensory contacts, sight, sound, smells, tastes, and that sort of thing, it is interested because it's intent on looking into consciousness, pure and simple, to see what arises in there and how it generates issues. Sensations, thoughts, labels for pleasure and pain and so forth are all natural phenomena that change as soon as they're sensed. And they're very refined. If you view them as being about this or that matter, you won't be able to know them for what they are. The more intricate the meanings you give them, the more lost you become. Lost in the whirls of the cycle of rebirth. The cycle of rebirth and the processes of thought fabrication are one and the same thing. As a result, we whirl around and around, lost in many, many levels of thought fabrication, not just one. The knowledge that would read the heart can't break through to know, for it whirls around and around in these very same thought fabrications, giving them meanings in terms of this or that, and then latching onto them. If it labels them as good, it latches onto them as good. If it labels them as bad, it latches onto them as bad. This is why the mind stays entirely in the whorls of the cycle of rebirth, the cycle of thought fabrication. For this reason, to see these things clearly requires the effort to stop and watch, to stop and know in an appropriate way, in a way that's just right. At the same time, you have to use your powers of observation. That's what will enable you to read your own consciousness in a special way. Otherwise, if you latch onto the issues of thoughts and labels, they'll keep you spinning around. So you have to stop and watch. Stop and know clearly by focusing down. Focusing down on the consciousness in charge. That way, your knowledge will become skillful. Ultimately, you'll see that there's nothing at all. Just the arising and disbanding occurring every moment in emptiness. If there's no attachment, there are no issues. There's simply the natural phenomenon of arising and disbanding. But since we don't see things simply as natural phenomena, we see them as being true and latch onto them as ourself, good, bad, and all sorts of other complicated things. This keeps us spinning around without knowing how to find a way out. What to let go of? We don't know. When we don't know, we're like a person who wanders into a jungle and doesn't know the way out, doesn't know what to do. Actually, what we have to let go of lies right smack in front of us, where the mind fashions things and gives them meanings so that it doesn't know the characteristics of arising and disbanding, pure and simple. If you can simply keep watching and knowing, without any need for meanings, thoughts, imaginings, simply watching the process of these things in and of itself, there won't be any issues. There's just the phenomenon of the present, arising, persisting, disbanding, arising, persisting, disbanding. There's no special trick to this, but you have to stop and watch, stop and know within yourself every moment. Don't let your awareness stream away from awareness to outside preoccupation. Gather it in so that it can know itself clearly, that there's nothing in there worth latching on to. It's all a bunch of deceits. To know just this much is very useful for seeing the truth inside yourself. You'll see that consciousness is empty of any self. When you look at physical phenomena, you'll see them as elements, as empty of any self. You'll see mental phenomena as empty of any self, as elements of consciousness. And that if there's no attachment, no latching on, there's no suffering or stress. So even if there's thinking going on in the mind, simply watch it, simply let it go, and its cycling will slow down. Fewer and fewer thought fabrications will occur. Even if the mind doesn't stop completely, it will form fewer and fewer thoughts. You'll be able to stop to watch, stop to know, more and more. And this way, you'll come to see the tricks and deceits of thought fabrications, mental labels, pleasure and pain, and so on. You'll be able to know that there's really nothing inside, that the reason you were deluded into latching onto things was because of ignorance, and that you made yourself suffer right there in that very ignorance. So you have to focus down on one point, one thing. Focusing on many things won't do. Keep mindfulness in place, stopping, knowing, seeing. Don't let it run out after thoughts and labels. But knowing it in this way requires that you make the effort to stay focused. Focused on seeing clearly, not just focused on making the mind still. Focus on seeing clearly. Look on in for the sake of seeing clearly. And contemplate how to let go. The mind will become empty in line with its nature in a way that you'll know exclusively within. So it's a very beautiful expression of that important principles of because Ajahn Chah, I've heard it so many times, and you're saying there's only two things you have to do in practice. Know and let go. That's a You know, it sounds so simple, but you know, it has to be investigated and seen and contemplated and be willing to keep coming back to that central focus, the central kind of heart of things.
Yes. So, about thought fabrication, right? About the thought fabrication,
yes.
In daily life, right, we still have to maintain our work,
yeah.
And when we are working, we still need to focus on the work, like even making effort into like doing our work, right? Then how can we integrate like, the principle of anatta, dukkha, and into the
life. Yes.
Life, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the you know, it's just sort of doing your work just because you need to do your work, and so often what happens is we get caught by how people judge us, we get caught in worries, am I doing it right, get caught in fear, I'm doing it wrong. So those are thought fabrications. The work just needs to be attended to. Of course, the main thing is in terms of work, you know, so long as it's right livelihood in the sense that it's ethical, it's not harming people, it's not taking advantage of people, then you know, you can put your effort and attention into applying the mind to the work itself, and not getting caught in the work that those worries and fears that tend to obsess the mind, and then there's actually energy left over to just to be with the work itself.
Okay.
And it's always going to display. It's just this nature of arising, persisting, and disbanding. So it keeps arising, staying, and disbanding. So that, in and of itself, it's an object of attention. Of course, you want to do as good a job as possible. You want to do it in a way that it's beneficial for oneself and beneficial for others. So it changes the, when one's not invested in it with the sense of self, then you know, a lot more possibilities.
Because like when I do my job, right, I still need to think about like how is it gonna like how to do it well and what it means by doing well and how like other people would like use it, for example. Then,
yeah.
I mean, there are all these kind of thoughts arising, and then like sometimes just get caught into this thought.
Some of it is useful in the sense of, okay, how do I do it so that it's useful for others? How do I do it so that it's well done?
Yeah.
That's a useful perspective to encourage oneself. Not obsessing and not worrying too much, but it's a helpful way of encouraging oneself to apply oneself in a skillful way, and then one can get caught up in all sorts of speculations do people approve or do they disapprove, and it can get complicated there. So then it's okay, I'm creating suffering where it's not necessary.
Then what should I do in that case, like when I get caught into?
Well, one is to say, oh, this is suffering. And then, okay, I need to let that go. I need to release. I need to relinquish. I need to not hold so tightly. Because otherwise it keeps the suffering perpetuating itself.
Paul,
yeah.
In the reading that you just did, Hasege Gi is she's describing the mind. She's sort of saying that the mind takes the fabrication of itself as the object. Just watching the rising and passing of a thought.
Yeah.
Is that similar to Ajahn Sumedho's It's Like This?
Yeah.
And so as the mind is doing that, she's saying it's quieting,
mm-hmm.
it will get fewer and fewer thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's a quieting in the mind that is noticed
mm-hmm.
with the mind. It seems like that would be an expansion. As the objects fewer and fewer, the mind is kind of expanding.
That's a label.
Is she then saying that at that point the mind will recognize the seeing of it? It's that.
I mean, one has to direct the attention in that way in order to see that or to experience that, because you can also start to, oh, my mind's expanding, look at that, I have another expansive mind now. you turn it into a whole other story.
What's the process of just allowing that, even that thought itself, to be recognized as
right? That is the process.
letting go. Too much knowing. Not
knowing
just letting go.
And letting go. Knowing and letting go. Laura.
Just on that thought, I understood what you read. She said something like being aware of awareness itself.
Yeah.
And that at that point, there aren't any objects in the mind to be aware of. It's like awareness has come home to itself,
mm-hmm.
and it's not creating a play or a show to look at. It's, yeah.
Whole new concept, isn't it?
Well, no. Actually, I've experienced.
Yeah,
briefly.
Yes.
And,
yeah,
it's the end of loneliness.
Yes, yes. You know, that's the that's where there's a real sense of peace. Because oftentimes what we conceive of peace is sort of getting the mind how we want it. But then it's more around kind of a clear knowing that isn't trying to create or be or become anything.
Yeah, and it was a very interesting experience because I realized there was no location to this awareness that was aware of itself. But then if I directed my mind outward, I could see things beyond where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got scared. it's not something I can do at the drop of a hat.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where it's sort of finding that anchor so that what it sees and experiences and understands is in even though there are understandings that arise, the basis of it is a very simple kind of letting go.
Is that, I'm reminded then of the, always the encouragement to come back to the body as
mm-hmm.
a basis.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it would simplify.
Yes, and that's where referring right back to the very, very first thing that Ajahn Mun
mm-hmm.
said of this cave of wonders,
mm-hmm.
And being the body, and But the main reason for doing that is recognizing that there's a simplification of the, say, the foundation of knowing and awareness. Because, you know, the habit, of course, the mind is so quick, and associations and its attention is so quickly drawn. So that's where, especially in terms of training and re-establishing focus, and finding a comfort and ease and familiarity with being in the body. It's really helpful. Okay, what's up?
I'm bored.
Okay. Let's have a break. It's almost 3 o'clock, so good to have a bit of a break. Maybe 3:15 we could gather again. Relax, walk around, get the blood flowing again. Ease the aches and pains.